Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. Have some public hearings today, four different bills. I will be going out of order today.
First time ever.
So I think we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3101. And we'll call up Representative Gomberg and Representative McCune.
And Representative.
Chair, committee members, this is a measure that prohibits a hotel or innkeeper from charging a facility fee that's in addition to the rental price of a guest room, and there are no amendments before you right now.
Thank you, and I appreciate you not bringing any controversial bills to my committee.
Always a pleasure, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For your record, I am David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Oregon coast, and I live in Lincoln City, Oregon, which happily boasts the most oceanfront hotel rooms between any place between Seattle and San Francisco. So as you might imagine, I am interested in tourism, I am interested in hotels, and I'm interested in making sure that people that visit them have an enjoyable stay and go home well satisfied with the experience, which is part of what the bill is about that I brought to you today. It has to do with clarity of information. And the situation is really quite simple. You want to plan a weekend away, you make a phone call and you say, how much is it going to cost me to stay with you this weekend? And the answer is $200 a night plus taxes. But when you come to check out, you find out that you're paying $230 a night plus taxes because they have added a mandatory fee on top of your room charges. A mandatory fee. Sometimes they're called resort fees. Sometimes they're called facility fees. The main thing is that they aren't called out in public as often as we might like. So I'm concerned about that experience in part because I want people who are calling around to have an idea what they're going to spend before they go rather than after they check out. But I also think that as they are, sometimes people call around and they consider a couple of different alternatives and they compare prices. And I want them to be able to compare equal prices across the board rather than finding out that one of the places that they were looking at did not have a resort fee and one of them did. Now, what kind of fees are we talking about, Mr. Chairman? I mentioned resort fees and facility fees. So let me make it clear. I am not talking about special fees for special activities that you do different from other people. For example, if you stay in downtown Portland and you bring a car, you may pay a parking fee when people who don't bring a car don't pay a parking fee. I think that's perfectly appropriate. Some places charge you if you bring pets. Some people charge you if you bring kids. Some people charge you if you engage in special activities. I'm not talking about anything special. I'm talking about the fees that everybody is charged no matter what they do. And if you were charged a resort fee because the facility has a swimming pool, a jacuzzi, and a tennis court, you get charged for those facilities whether you use them or not. I had my staff do some calling around, Mr. Chairman, just to get some ideas, and we called a couple of different places at random to find out what was going on. And I mean, I found, and I'm not going to name names because this is not about blaming anybody. This is just about clarifying the situation. A resort in Central Oregon that adds a 15% fee per night. $200 room, $15 fee, that's an extra $30 a night that you weren't expecting. Another one in Deschutes County, 7% in additional fees that were not listed in the pricing. In my own Lincoln County, a $15 additional fee that is on the website but not included in the prices that are posted. An $8 mandatory fee, a $7.82 additional fee, a $20 mandatory fee due upon checkout. And again, these are different locations, and there may be other facilities nearby that that don't charge the same kind of fee. So there's the potential for awkward surprises when it comes time to check out. Again, what I'm looking for is clarity of information so people are able to know what they're going to pay in advance when they make a decision to go and have good information to compare one facility to another when they're deciding where to go to. And that's the essence of the bill I brought to you. I presented it as stop charging mandatory fees. I'm open to the possibility that we change it to say that if you're going to charge these kind of fees, that you disclose them in advance so that everybody knows what's going on. on. My good friend and neighboring Representative McEwen has a different kind of situation that she's dealing with and a possible amendment, so I'm going to turn to her at that point.
Thank you, Representative Gomberg. For the record, my name is Kati McEwen. I represent House District 9, Coos Bay to Yahotson and almost to Elmira. I have an interesting situation. When Representative Gomberg's bill appeared, I immediately got a call from my county commissioners expressing grave concern for a very unusual reason. And so in the attempt to craft a very friendly amendment, here's the situation that we're dealing with in Coos County. We have a transient lodging tax in Coos County that's applied to facilities that are inside city limits, which excludes the Bandon Dunes Golf Resort. And so in a very friendly way, Bandon Dunes realizes that they want to be taxed and pay their part into the county coffers, particularly to support public safety in a county that is strapped for funds. So there's an arrangement that's been made between the Bandon Dunes Golf Resort and Coos County to impose a facility fee on their guests, and it gets passed through directly to the county in lieu of a transient lodging tax, which they don't impose because they aren't required to. So my county commissioners are very concerned that the language in Representative Gomberg's bill may preclude them from collecting that voluntary fee from the Bandon Dunes Golf Resort, which helps the county in providing public safety services. So we have legislative council drafting an amendment that would hopefully address the issue for this very unusual situation where we have somebody who is begging to be taxed and wants to provide those funds to help support a county that's challenged. So Representative Gomberg and I have been discussing this. Legislative council is involved, and hopefully we can carve out something that will allow that to continue to happen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brock Smith has another unusual situation.
Well, thank you, Chairman Holvey and committee. David Brock Smith, State Representative, House District 1, where Bandon Dunes is located. And, of course, all over 80% of Coos County. And so I had the same phone call from the county commissioners.
Share our county commissioners.
In Coos County. But I also have a situation where other lodging facilities charge facilities fees and may help our public safety services in Curry County. And so I was happy to hear, and we're working on an amendment, a future amendment as well, to where we can clarify that, and happy to hear that we might be able to get to a place of needing to disclose that if there's going to be any fees.
Mr. Chairman, in closing, again, I'm looking for people to know in advance what it's going to cost them to go someplace. And I started out talking about these mandatory facility or resort fees, and the thing that I want to leave you with is that I believe that this is a tool being used by some people to artificially decrease what it appears people will have to pay to stay there. And that these fees should be treated as a lodging cost. And the reason I conclude that is because these mandatory fees are, in fact, subject to the transient lodging tax. Let me say that again. You pay a room tax not only on the cost of the room, but also on the resort fee. So why isn't the resort fee part of the lodging cost? The answer is, it is. They're just not disclosing it up front. And I don't believe that these people are being purposely deceptive or trying to scam anybody. I just think that it's an emerging trend that that we should try to turn around to the betterment of people that visit the good hotels and the resorts here in Oregon.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and commend you for looking out for the reputation of tourism in this state. I think it's really important. Questions, Representative Doherty.
Well, this might be kind of a naive question, but if you go to the resorts and you don't use the tennis courts, the swimming pool, and all of the amenities that you're paying for over and above your room cost, do you get a refund?
No, ma'am. Mr. Chairman, Representative Doherty, you still pay the fee. And in the case of one of these wonderful facilities that that my wife enjoys visiting a lot, we went there in December and didn't use the pool or the tennis court, but still got charged the resort fee because we were at a resort.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the staff summary, it says, in 2012, the Federal Trade Commission sent letters to major hotel operators reminding them that they should be including any mandatory resort fees in the reservation rate quoted to customers. Is that something that's, is it in federal statute or that people are required to disclose? Obviously, it's not in state statute if that's something we're talking about here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fahey, I think that would be a great question to ask the next person who plans to testify. Mr. Perry is here on behalf of the Restaurant and Lodging Association,
great.
And he would be in a better position to answer that than I would.
Thank you.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward. Appreciate it. And I look forward to hearing what everybody else has to say. But I'm curious on the parking fee. Oftentimes you get there and then you have a parking fee you weren't anticipating either. Is that included in this conversation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hack, the answer is no, because not everybody brings a car. So it's not a mandatory fee that applies to everyone who stays at the facility. It only applies to those who bring automobiles with them.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Byrne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gomberg. My question is, are these fees typically subject to franchise fees?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bynum, I don't know the answer to that question. It's an excellent question. I indicated with some emphasis that these fees are subject to the room tax, which I find very interesting, but I don't know whether they are subject to a franchise fee or not.
Other questions? Not seeing any. I appreciate you bringing the issue forward, and hopefully you can work out some amendments that seem amenable to everybody.
Thank you.
Or
if not, just let us know what you come back with. Bill Perry.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. And I'll say up front to Representative Fahey, I don't know the answer to that question, and I will try to get an answer and get back to you. Obviously, as it's written now, we would oppose the bill. Obviously, anything that bans these fees, we would not be in support of. If it's the letting the consumer know that a fee is mandatory, I don't think as an industry we have any issues with that. So obviously, we need to see how that is written, and I think that would hopefully solve both the other representatives' problems. There's a lot of different reasons you have these. Like on the coast, some of these places are condos, and so anytime you rent it out, they require a facility fee because your guests are being using them. In Sun River, obviously, a lot of those are rentals, and so they require resort fees. And so there are different reasons for these. And so obviously, we want to just be able to make sure that all those are met. But if they want to make sure that the consumer knows before they sign up, before they check in, or however we want to word that, I don't think we're going to have any issues with it. And kind of around the other things, when he said they're subject to the tax, anything that is a requirement of the room, no matter what, is subject to the tax. It doesn't matter what it is. Anything that is optional to the guest is not subject to the tax. So that is the distinction of what gets taxed and what doesn't. So as for Representative Fahey's question, I can try to get an answer to that, but I don't know that off the top of my head. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions? You want to try to rephrase the question so we could answer it? Or no. Don't see any questions. I do think it's important consumers, know what they're going to be charged when they make their reservations. Mm-hmm. That's pretty. I think that's just good policy. So,
yeah.
Appreciate your willingness to work with the sponsors and the representatives to see what can be done.
Mm-hmm. And I want to note it for record, I have several members that are voluntarily paying tax when they're not required to. So, we should be able to get some brownie points for that, right?
Okay. I don't usually award those, but I'll keep it in mind.
Wishful thinking.
Yes, go ahead.
Committee chair members, I included that information in the staff measure summary, and there's just a little more I can explain, and if we bring this bill back, I'll have it in writing on the staff measure summary. But the FTC was looking at any violations of Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, and that's Title 15 of the United States Code, and it's for misrepresenting any hotel room reservation prices.
There you have it. bigger issue than we thought. So thank you very much. Nobody else has signed up to testify on House Bill 3101. Going to close public hearing on House Bill 3101 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3305.
Mr. Chair.
Give us a preview.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that brought to you by Representative Stark, and the measure extends Oregon's lemon law to include travel trailers, declares an emergency, effective on passage, and no amendments to do.
Thank you. Representative Stark.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon. Today I have Chris and Barbara Green with me. They're constituents of mine in Central Point, and you'll have an opportunity to hear from them in just a moment, their story. Many of us grew up with the good old saying, when life gives you lemons,
Make lemonade.
Just making sure a few of you grew up with that. Thank you for helping me out in that report. You know, and that's a good policy for the most part. Sometimes life deals you a bad deal, and you just got to figure out a way to make it work. However, sometimes the lemons that you get served are rotten, and you can't actually make lemonade from those, which is why a number of years back we created the lemon law here in Oregon for motorized vehicles. And the idea is, you know, people go out and they save up their money and they put their money into a vehicle, and vehicles are important. And we've managed to make sure we extend that even to RV vehicles, you know, recreational vehicles and so forth. And so we have people who will sometimes, and if you think about like grandparents especially, okay, I'm thinking of my wife's grandparents right now. The first thing they did when they retired, they sold their house, bought a cheaper house, and bought an RV because it was their lifetime dream to be able to travel the country in their RV. And now times have changed, and we've realized and acknowledged the idea and the fact that, you know what, sometimes you buy something brand new, and even with the warranty, after you've taken it back over and over, they can't seem to fix the problem. And at some point, you say, enough is enough. Replace it with something that's the same or equal in value. Sometimes it's just, you should be able to just cut your loss and move on. That's what the lemon law is all about. Now, I think it's time for us to actually expand what we're doing with the lemon law. And the reason is, if you take a look at RVs these days, RVs have taken all sorts of shapes and forms. And so now you have people who will save up and invest. And when they go out to the lot, they can have an opportunity to sit down and say, well, should I buy an RV that has a motor in it, or should I buy a fifth wheel? And some of these fifth wheels can cost as much as a small house, and get it with a truck. And maybe I want the fifth wheel so that when I park it, I can actually get in my truck and drive around and go fishing down the road and then come back to it. And it's my belief that those people who invested their money in those things should have the same sorts of protections that we give to those who have RVs with a motor. Now, you know, good old Chair Holvey, last session, or last biennium, I had an opportunity to serve with you on the Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness Committee, and as much as I despise that committee, there's something that, like, stuck with me, and I still pay attention to some of these things. And in fact, the AG's office recently released, you know, their top 10 complaints, and still in that top 10 deals with motorized vehicles. Okay, so this is still an ongoing issue that people are having. So what happened in this scenario is my constituents a few months back reached out to my office saying, hey, is there anything you can do about this? This doesn't seem right. And you'll hear their story in just a moment. And so we reached out, you know, my good old staff reached out to the AG's office. And next thing you know, we realized, oh, you guys, you've heard a lot of this. And they said, well, yeah, we have. And in fact, we will help you draft the legislation. That's how important it was to them and how much they're hearing this sort of thing. So when it comes to the details of the lemon law, I'm no expert. When it comes to the details of the bill, I'm not an expert. I can vouch for the concept, and we're going to have the AG's office up here be able to answer specific questions about the bill itself here in just a minute. But before we get into their, you know, my constituents' stories, I do want to let you guys know that it was just recently made aware, or I was just recently made aware, that in drafting the bill, we unintentionally, RVs have some things that they spell out that are not covered in the lemon law. current statute and so forth. So, and trying to add the travel trailers to that, we unintentionally did not have those things, same things, not covered. And so we plan on an amendment to make sure that the language matches up on the two of those, that the things that are excluded for RVs, that we're going to exclude for fifth wheels and so forth as well. So on that note, unless there are questions for me, I will try to stop talking, try is the key word there, and allow my constituents to share their story.
Just for a point of clarity, though, Representative Stark, you didn't despise that committee.
Did I say
because,
despise?
Because I was not chairing it. It was just something more general.
Absolutely. Chair Holby,
Fifth Amendment.
You were not chairing that committee.
Okay, just wanted to put that on the record.
Despise might be strong, but I was greatly relieved when that committee went out of existence.
I know. It's a challenging committee for you.
It's
good for protection. So go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thank you, committee. I'm Barbara Green, and this is my husband, Chris Green. And we have owned different types of RVs, travel trailers, for 35 years. This wasn't our first one. So we've had them for many, many years. We was getting ready to retire, so we decided to buy our dream RV that would haul our toys, our side-by-side and four-wheelers and that kind of thing, plus our grandkids. So that's why we bought a large one. So right off the bat when we bought it, and then we bought it in the fall of 2015, and right off the bat we had bought a truck to go with it. When we hooked the electrical lights in to the truck, it has an alarm that tells you you've hooked your trailer up to the truck. And we got down the road about 15 minutes and the alarm started going off, so we checked everything. That was just the beginning. That alarm went off every 15 minutes, and the dealership tried to fix it. It never got fixed. It's still not fixed. And so anyway, that was the beginning. It went on from there. We had a wiring problem. Found a wad of wiring that fell down that got tangled up in the axle. And then we was making a trip over to the coast, and my husband was blowing off the roof and discovered that something was going on with the roofing. And so it had come to find out, had come from the manufacturer default. It was cut around, and that's why you have those pictures. It was cut around. That hole is where the air conditioner is over the master bedroom. And apparently when they put that in, it cut the roofing. So it had leaked from the manufacturer, and it had set on the dealership's lot for 6 months before we bought it. So for 6 months, it had been leaking. So we bought this new trailer that had been leaking. And so the dealership tried to fix it. It went from bad to worse. They ended up having to put a whole new roofing system in there. They had to replace panelings inside the roof. And we are still not confident in this trailer because the water had been sitting in there. Water goes everywhere. So, they would have to tear the trailer apart to make sure that it was free of mold. And then you no longer have a trailer, a new one. You have one that's been tore apart. So that was where our concern was, and when we reached out to the office to, you know, see if there was anything that they could help. This goes beyond warranty. This goes beyond the structure of the trailer. After the warranty's gone, we're still going to be dealing with water problems because it travels throughout the trailer, down the sides, the lamination. There's all kinds of ramification on this. So this has gone beyond that. With trying to deal with them, they were only limited to what the warranty said that they had to do, and that was it. So we're stuck with this trailer that's devalued. greatly. So we have went ahead and we've gone to court. That's why we support this bill, because it's not going to help us now, because we're already in the court system. It can't help us. But for people, and I have young adult children, they have RVs, they're buying new RVs, you know, they need some protection out there. If we have some way that we can go back and say, okay, this has had so many major problems that it's devalued the vehicle, you know, the trailer, then, you know, you need to do something. Whereas right now, we don't have no recourses. And so that's one of the reasons why we want to recommend this bill. Also, we kind of feel like with this lemon law, that it kind of balances the power for us as consumers with the manufacturers. Right now, they have all the power. We don't. They get to do whatever they think fits the warranty. And we have no recourse other than to go to court. And so anyway, we're thinking with this bill that would help us as consumers having a little more balance of power there. So I think that was about it, unless you have any questions for me. But thank you for allowing us to share that.
Yes. Thank you for coming and sharing your story. It's important for us to hear things when we know the system isn't quite working right. Consumer protection is important. We do take these issues seriously. So I don't know if your husband had anything to add.
I'm a technical guy.
Well, and it was like the story, like our representative said, you know, we had saved up, and this was part of our retirement plan and stuff, and so now we're using it all to go to court and stuff, so we're hoping we can get that money back. But
I hope so, yeah. Too. Questions, Representative Hurd?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep Stark, maybe it was covered and I didn't hear it. Is there? I was looking through the bill and it talks about a 24,000-mile period for motorized RVs. Is there something coming in the amendment, or am I missing something to make that apply to the trailers?
Yeah. Chair Hovey, Rep Hurd, in just a minute, the AG's office can give you more details on the manufacturing. One of the issues with extending this from a motorized vehicle that has an odometer to something that doesn't have an odometer is how do you actually figure out the cost of the usage and so forth. And so there is a factor, and I'll let them explain it in just a moment. On page 3 of the bill, line 11, where it goes into how you would actually, the calculation of figuring out the equivalent rate based off of a rental and the number of days used and so forth. But the AG's office is better situated to answer that.
Follow up. There are hub odometers, just to say that to you. I've used those on trailers and whatnot to keep track of stuff, too, so that could be something that could be applied to help keep track of that. Okay. But also, my parents actually experienced something very similar to what you dealt with, and they ended up selling the trailer to a family member who had a cover to put it under to live in for almost nothing, because it just, after a while, it had almost no value.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony today and bringing the bill forward. So up next, let's have Vince Porter and Cheryl Hinsworth. And we should probably have some separation between the two of you, because
I'll let her go first. Oh.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice for the Attorney General. So as you have heard from Representative Stark, they called us probably last fall already about this issue, and we began to dive into it. I would like to note for the record, however, that Rep. Stark in 2015 did carry one of our consumer protection bills on the floor quite well from the Consumer Protection Committee. So, yeah.
And he probably despised doing it.
So we heard the complaint, and we had some other cases sort of like this that was flagged in our consumer complaint hotline from a few folks, and so we looked into the language here. What we discovered was that RVs, at least the sort of car part of the RV, was already covered under the Lemon Law, but travel trailers were not. So what I did was we just pulled the definition of travel trailer, I think, from existing DMV statutes, so there wouldn't be any confusion about what we're talking about here. And then what we did after that was to look into the different parts of the Lemon Law. So already in statute, the manufacturer gets a reasonable number of attempts to fix the lemon. We're not changing that. The issue comes in, if it's unfixed, then what happens with the refund or the replacement? Replacement, just replace it with a new travel trailer. With the refund, the issue becomes with this 24,000-mile issue. From what we can tell, most manufacturers didn't have an odometer on a travel trailer, and requiring that as a manufacturing requirement, we could only do that in Oregon law for travel trailers manufactured in Oregon, so that wasn't really a good global fix that I could see. So what we did was we said, okay, for the refund issue, what happens right now is, let's say you, let's go back to the motor vehicle, if you've got 5,000 miles on that car, what the dealer gets to do is basically deduct that from the refund. So you got at least some mileage out of it, the dealer should be able to get some reimbursement for that. So what that language is on page 3 is just saying, if they do need some reimbursement, basically the number of days that that trailer has been in use multiplied by their average reasonable rate of a rental. That was kind of the only comparison I could think of analogous to the motor vehicle law. As far as the 24,000-mile cap for the sort of statute of limitations, I'll call it, on this. Couldn't think of an analogous situation for that. So the current motor vehicle law is 2 years or 24,000 miles. So this would be capped at the 2-year mark as well. So that's kind of the thinking behind the logic there. I think we're happy to sit down and chat about amendments if that's where we need to go next.
Thank you. First, are there any questions for your girl? Not seeing any, so go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vince Porter. I'm a lobbyist for Strategies 360, and we're here representing the Recreational Vehicle Industry Association. First, I want to say that the RVIA is absolutely in favor of consumer protection, and the issue that we heard earlier in testimony is something that, you know, we fully endorse and would be happy to help assist with any manufacturer who is behaving outside of the bounds of the law. That being said, RVIA is in opposition to this bill for three different reasons. First of all, we believe that RV trailers are used for temporary lodging and not considered transportation, and we believe that the intent of the Lemon Law bill was to focus on vehicles that required transportation. In 2009, when motorhomes were included, I think it was pointed out that the motorhomes were only covering the engine and the parts that are relating to transportation of that vehicle. It did not include the appliances or other parts of the trailer that were considered the living quarters. This bill would actually, with the travel trailer, would right now include everything that's within the travel trailer, and we find that inconsistent with what the motorhomes currently have are under current law. It also begs the question, and this is something I imagine will come up in a work group at 3 o'clock, but it could even extend into tiny homes or other things that are sitting on wheels today that are either permanent or temporary housing. And so we have some concerns about the level of inclusion on bringing this into a Lemon Law. We also believe that the intent of the Lemon Law was really focused on mandatory or non-discretionary transportation or non-discretionary vehicles. Travel trailers on average nationally are used 20 to 30 days a year, and so we believe that there is appropriate methods where we should be able to come up and remedy the problems that would be in travel trailers without declaring it a full lemon. Lastly, we are concerned about the mileage issue, in that the fact that we can't define the mileage issue and can't come up with an adequate refund, the current definition of the leasing formula, we're not sure that that's clear enough and would be concerned about how you would manage what the appropriate leasing amount would be for deduction on any kind of refund. So thank you very much. Appreciate you giving us the time for testimony.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. Ms. Hamster, can you, let's suppose one has a travel trailer or a fifth wheeler of some sort, and they're not succeeding in getting the dealer and the manufacturer to satisfy the problem. What at this point are their legal alternatives?
Chair Holby, Representative Kinnemer, I think like the constituents from Rep. Stark, you go to court. That would obviously be an option. You know, there may be some warranty, but it sounds like, you know, there's ways that manufacturers defend against that, of course. Other than that, I mean, I think that's all I can think of at the moment.
So. Follow up. Do you go against the dealer or against the manufacturer or both?
Chair Holby, Representative Kinnemer, hypothetically, if I were the lawyer there, I'd probably go after both, yes.
Okay. That's what I wanted. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What right now is the typical warranty for a travel trailer, and then what does it cover?
Chair Holby, Rep. Barreto, I would probably give you inaccurate testimony if I imagine it varies from manufacturer to manufacturer, but I'd be happy to follow up and get the appropriate answer to you.
Okay. Are they required to provide a warranty?
Chair Hovey, that too is something I will follow up and get you the correct answer, but I believe the answer is yes.
Okay. And one other question. So in the consumer's situation when they need or seeking, you know, a remedy, their option is to go to court. How do the attorney fees work in this particular type of issue?
Ooh, Chair Holby, I think I actually don't know for sure. So
okay.
I can look that up for you.
Whether they're prevailing party, prevailing
right.
plaintiff.
I don't think they're prevailing party, but I'll have to check on that.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to know, since it seems to be a topic we always have looming around. And also, if there is a requirement, I don't know if there's a statutory requirement in Oregon for warranties on recreational vehicles versus travel trailers. I don't know that.
Chair Holby, I don't think there is a requirement for a warranty, but again, I can look into that too.
Okay. And it would be useful to know in warranties what do they typically cover. That would also be helpful, I think. Yeah, you know, if there's information out there from the industry on that, I appreciate that information. Thank you both very much for your testimony today. And I didn't see anyone else signed up for House Bill 3305. There is actually two more people that would like to testify on House Bill 3305.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I just simply wanted to put our organization on record in support. Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is John Gere. I'm a consumer attorney. I represent a lot of consumers, and I've had a couple of fifth-wheel travel trailer cases, and they are terribly heartbreaking because inevitably these are older people who have invested a very significant sum, more than my first house cost, in a product. They find that the Lemon Law that protects the truck that pulls the trailer doesn't protect the defective, often a leaky product behind that they're towing behind them. There's a forced arbitration clause stuck into nearly all of these contracts from the manufacturers, and they have to keep paying on their note. They've borrowed money, they've financed this trailer, they're paying for something they can't use, and they're in tears. Because they say, well, now if we sell, we bought this truck to pull this thing, the dealer will only give us 60% of what we paid for the truck. The other dealer says, we fixed your trailer, and they show me pictures of leaking trailer, and there is no recourse. If they go, there is no requirement for a warranty. If there is a written warranty, it's covered under the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, but you get into the forced arbitration. You can't get to court. Thank goodness these people somehow didn't get forced into arbitration. But these are a terrible product. And I tell people, rent an RV, never buy an RV. And, you know, that's too bad. But this industry needs cleaning up. And if bringing it under the Lemon Law will do that, that's what it needs to happen.
Representative Kinnemer.
Would you expound a little bit on the forced arbitration clause? Because I understand some of that, but that's a way to avoid court, going to court and other alternatives.
It's a way to avoid facing a jury. The makers, typically in Indiana, this is an industry that is consolidating massively. There's now only a couple of people who make RVs. They do it under a whole host of nameplates. But they write these contracts. They're adhesion contracts. And they're in microscopic mice type. And in there, the consumer, when buying the trailer and financing the trailer, agrees to give up their right to seek a remedy for defects. So there's no compulsion, there's no pressure on the maker to actually resolve their problem, because if the consumer gets a lawyer, the lawyer says, well, bad news, you don't get to go to court. You can't have a jury decide, did this maker treat you right? You'll be forced into private arbitration, unrecorded, secret, so there's no law, there will be no precedent set. Other consumers will never be able to find out about this dealer and this maker, and whether you get attorney fees or even a remedy is completely up to the whim of the arbitrator, and there's virtually impossible to get an arbitrator's decision even appealed, much less overturned.
And follow up. And also, generally in these, you don't have any authority to help select the arbitrator.
The arbitrators are picked by the company that picked the arbitration company.
Okay.
And they're typically defense firms or retired jurists. And the consumer can be made to pay for the arbitration. And there's no way to find out, is this a biased arbitrator? There's no way to determine, did this guy spend his career defending RV makers before turning to arbitration?
Mr. Chairman, just one more, and I think this is a comment.
As follow-up comment.
Who had a lot of trailers, I used to refer to them as leaks on wheels.
Yes.
And I think that tends to be the experience, particularly if you take them over rough roads and into the backcountry and a few things that four-wheel drive vehicles can do.
Which is what they're sold to do.
And frankly, that's what you expect them to be able to do.
Chair Hulvey and Representative Cameron, I just wanted to piggyback on the question regarding forced arbitration. One of the other dilemmas that Mr. Gere touched on, I think, but I want to emphasize, is that the rules for discovery of information are much different in if you go to a trial by jury. You're able to discover documents that the company might have. In the arbitration, you're not. We're investigating these problems in the area of long-term care also, where you can imagine consumers coming in to sign an admission contract for a skilled nursing facility, assisted living, something like that. They're under a lot of duress. Maybe they're suffering from dementia, whatever it might be. And they're having to sign away their rights, as Mr. Gere described in that setting, too. And so this is a broad consumer issue. I'm really glad you raised it. Thank you.
So along those lines, the forced arbitration, is there any place that's made forced arbitration illegal, or is this just something that's really common in contracts, and you can just, on the dotted line, when you sign it, you're giving away your rights, basically, to seek a remedy or in court? Doesn't seem right.
When the Federal Forced Arbitration Act was passed in 1924, consumers and employees, employer labor disputes, as they were called, were never brought under. It wasn't until the 70s that businesses started trying to use them in consumer contracts, and the Supreme Court precedent governing right now in the United States is that, hey, it's a matter of contractual rights. You can sign away your rights even if it was never brought to your attention that you were signing away your rights. As long as it's somewhere in the document you signed, you have forced arbitration clause on every credit card, every bank account, every lease, every telephone, all your utilities. You have signed away your rights, and the Supreme Court says not a problem.
And so the state really doesn't have any purview trying to address that issue. It's preempted by the federal government. Is that what I'm hearing, sort of?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, we're investigating what the possibilities are. I have a sense that we may be ranging a little bit far afield from the topic at hand based on who joined us here at the table. But
yeah,
I did
yeah
want
but
to,
I'm just, the judge of that.
Oh, okay. Representative Holvey wouldn't, Representative Stark would not despise serving on this committee then.
Yeah. So. No, I think he would. I'll let him speak for himself. Do you want to testify twice on this bill?
Thank you, Chair Holvey, for your latitude and me sneaking back up here. I wanted to make a clarification. Earlier, my constituent referenced court. The scenario is that they are in forced arbitration right now based off of the contract. And, in an idea, and I just received permission to share this, so the latest offer, now that their warranty is about to run out on this thing, their latest offer was basically $18,000. And they get to keep the vehicle, which is now devalued, has black mold that they feel like they can't use safely with the children in it. And they paid $75,000 cash down. Okay, so that some of the problems of the forced arbitration on these things. And so I just wanted to clarify, because we said court and someone said, oh, good for them, they got into court. That's not actually the case. It is an arbitration.
Oh, even sadder. Representative Barreto was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stark, do you know what the warranty was? Was it a 2-year warranty? 1-year warranty?
I was just informed that it was a 1-year
warranty.
Yeah, and
then warranty. Maybe, can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up, certainly.
So maybe from an attorney standpoint, our manufacturer, first of all, these travel trailers, they go down the road, they try and build them as light as possible with all the amenities in them, and so they have basically an area of building something lightweight to try and make it last, to try and make it durable. Someone mentioned going down bumpy roads, and so it's a little bit of a difficult task they have. Are they required by law to give a warranty at all?
Representative, Mr. Chair Holvey and Representative Barreto, they're not, to my knowledge, and I have researched this. I won't swear that they're not, but I know of nothing that requires, and Magnuson-Moss does not require warranties. It places requirements on makers if they do give a written warranty, but I am 99.99% certain they are not required to give a warranty. Most of them do, but it's that great old song, the large print giveth and the small print taketh away, and that's how those RV warranties work. What you can find is that if the wheels fall off, you might be able to get some help, but if it's leaking full of mold, if it won't insulate, you're going to have a hard time. I've had two of these cases, and they're the worst cases I've ever had, because you have no real lemon law, even though it's a $70,000-$80,000, $100,000-$200,000 product with the slide outs. If you can't balance it and you can't do the slide outs, the consumer is left not getting what they paid for in any respect, and the maker can drag it on and on and on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. As I'm sitting here, I think it might be something we may want to do is ask staff to check with legislative counsel. If my recollection is correct, we have talked about forced arbitration clauses in times past.
Yes, I recall that as well.
But I can't remember the specifics of whether we got anywhere. It seemed to me that we did partly, and Mr. Towers is sort of nodding his head. Maybe he goes back and remembers that.
I don't remember getting anywhere useful, evidently.
Well, I think there are some ways you can countermand it, but I can't recall.
Well, let's bring that back up at a later date. We'll have that conversation again, perhaps. I want to move on with the rest of the committee agenda instead of talking about forced arbitration for the next hour. So thank you very much for your testimony today. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3305. And let's go. Stand at ease for about 5 or 15 seconds. Thank you. I'm going to like to reconvene the House Business and Labor Committee. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3322. And Catherine Ann Bannick, please. Jan, could you give us a brief description of the bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure requires certification from DCBS to operate a vehicle repair shop. It requires a bond or letter of credit in the amount of $40,000 for each location of the shop, and it requires insurance coverage. It sets the application fee at $1,100 plus $350 for each additional location. Directs the department to set and rule any expiration date for the certificate and the renewal. Allows the department to petition court to enjoin a person from engaging in the business as a vehicle repair shop if they're not certified. Allows the court to assess a penalty not to exceed $15,000 if the business is not certified. And allows the department to inspect the premises. Becomes operative January 1, 2018, and there is an emergency clause.
Thank you. If you introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Catherine Bannick, and thank you for hearing my story. We have a 32-foot presidential motorhome, and we were wanting to have some repairs done on it. We took it to Chaz Auto, and we gave him a little list of what needs to be done, and he said it would be cost approximately $1,457. But it could go up to $3,200. So I gave him all the money I had in my purse, and then about 7 days later, gave him a visa thing for it altogether, it was $2,700. And so he said it would be about 2 weeks because there were six jobs ahead of him, us. And so we said, okay, we were going to go. This happened to be on April 28th. We had the motorhome towed to this Chaz Auto because it wouldn't run. And he said it would be about 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks, we called, and they hadn't even begun anything. And repeatedly through the months, Chaz Auto had our motorhome for a year and approximately 5 months. And we would go in and ask what needs to be done, and they gave every excuse they could think of. And we would call about every 2 weeks to find out, you know, what's the holdup? Oh, they couldn't find a part. Oh, this, that. The guy's on vacation that works on it. Whatever feeble thing they had. Finally, on April 28th, 14, and April 17, 2015, I wanted to ask for a photocopy of the receipt, and or the what do you call it, printout thing, and the gal wouldn't do it, and she ended up calling the police. I ended up calling the police, and they said that she wouldn't. They said it wasn't against the law for me to ask for a printout of the work order. So she did, but she said that it wasn't accurate. They wanted $1,450. I gave him $2,700. And after about several months, On April 17, 2015, she said that we only owed $1,412 and that they were still working on the repairs. And I went into the motorhome, and I thought something was done because they had that middle cover over the engine thing up. So I was thankful that something was being done. Then I got a notice saying that there was a lien put against it and that they were going to sell it. Where is it? Sell it at an auction for $7,513, but they were only going to offer to have it bought back for $200. I had to go to the lawyer, and she wrote out somebody had been living in it while it was there on their lot. They were going to charge us $1,000 for having it on their lot, and the work hadn't been started at all. And they charged us $1,500 to get the motorhome back. Now, we will not be able to get recompensed for this. It should have been $11,800-something, because they stole everything out of it. It was emptied. Our brand-new stuff, because we were going to use it for a memorial weekend at the beach. And so they stole everything. So altogether, it costs us $4,200 plus they were going to sell it for $7,500. That's our story.
Mr. Gere, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is John Gear. This case was referred to me by a lawyer in Hillsboro because she knows I do consumer work. And I investigated the repair shop here. In addition to the numerous tax liens against the individual who owns this repair shop, the business is insolvent, continuing to take consumers' money. And there's no prospect of recovery. Suing this person would be like, suing a movie character. I mean, there's no possibility of recovery. This man is in business, and he is giving people the business and hurting people because he takes their vehicles. He has the law on his side for the mechanics lien. He's able to apply a mechanics lien to anything that comes onto his lot and claims to have worked on. Mm-hmm. But there's no pot from which a wronged consumer can recover. I gave you a list of 398 occupation and institutions that are required to have licenses and registrations in Oregon, and the theme of those lists is protection of the public. There is a huge hole in our system. Anyone can be, you all of you and I can go into business as auto repair shops tonight and take consumers' money and not know how to fix their brakes, not know how to fix their cars, keep their money, apply a lien to what they gave us, and when it comes out to the fact that we have no assets to pay a judgment, the consumer is left with nothing.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would this apply to, I'm assuming, I'm from Southern Oregon, rural community. Would this new legislation apply to individuals who want to work on a pickup, whether it's changing oil for folks or what have you out of their garage? I'm assuming it would create a whole new certificate. The bond requirement, up to $15,000 fine would apply to them just for engaging in that kind of service. Is that correct?
What it does is it uses the existing Vehicle Repair Shop Act in 646A.480 to 496 defines a vehicle repair shop, and it says a vehicle repair shop, and this requirement applies today, is anyone who does vehicle repairs for money. And that requirement is in there today. What this would require them to do is get a license and post a bond, a payment bond, so when they rip people off, there's a pot to recover from.
Follow up. So currently it's not required that you have a license to engage in this?
Absolutely not.
So the concern I have, and Miss, I'm so sorry that's happened to you, and I know you're not alone in that. The concern I have is, from where I'm from in Southern Oregon, in the rural community, there's a lot of folks that are pretty good at taking care of gas or diesel engine vehicles and whatnot. A lot of the professional shops, if you will, that are handling a lot of business, and I've heard these kinds of stories out of those types of entities as well, they're really expensive. A lot of times they're way overbooked. One example I'll give, and then I'll be quiet, is the Ford dealership in my community wanted $5,000 to replace my transmission in my pickup. I was able to get it done for $1,500. That's parts and labor, by an individual working out of his house. I'm very satisfied, and I saved a lot of money. So, I mean, there's a good side to it as well. I'm concerned that that big of a fine and the paperwork that's going to come along with it to be certified, if you will, there's going to be a lot of people in rural communities that are not going to be aware of that, maybe can't afford it, and they're going to get hit with some monstrous fines, and it's going to further discourage economic commerce within my already struggling economy community.
Representative Hurd, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee, I can tell you that no regulatory system is perfect. I mean, every one of these people who's licensed, the attempt is that you have to get the bad apples and you end up with a licensing system that imposes a burden on, I mean, I carry $300,000 PLF coverage. I have to have a license. Cosmetologists, crematoriums, tattoo artists, you know, all of the people on this list. It is not intended to burden the good actors, but to create a requirement that says only the bad guys have to get the license and post the bond. Oddly, nobody thinks they're a bad guy. I don't know how to split that for you, except that there are a lot of fly-by-night car dealers all over Oregon, not just in the rural parts, but all over Portland and Hillsboro and Beaverton. They rent a shop, they throw up a sign, and they take people's money, and they have the whip hand, and consumers and people trying to get to work end up having their car in hostage, and lawyers tell them, there's nothing I can do for you. That guy has nothing. I'm glad you got a good deal. I think a reputable guy, whether he works out of his home or anywhere else, will not. I have a great mechanic myself. I think the reputable mechanics would be glad to have the bad ones driven out by a licensing requirement. And the good ones, it will impose a cost, and that will be passed on to the consumers, a few dollars on every repair order probably. But that is a cheap insurance compared to the kinds of things that this lady suffered.
Thank you. Representative Evans, you want to go down there? You can sit right there.
Okay.
I didn't call on you. I didn't see you on the list. And forgive me for not calling on you first, but I know this is your bill. And
would you prefer me go down there or here?
Whatever you want to do.
I'll make it
most expedient to sit right there.
I'll make it very quick. This bill, as is obvious of the circumstance, relates to a problem that is both real and happens across the state. Since the bill's been put in, I've had a number of conversations with industry folks and some of the good vehicle repair shops. And if it would be helpful, I certainly would be willing to try to put a small work group together and report back with some amendments to be able to make this a little more practical, as well as something that, quite frankly, industry seemed very interested in some aspects of it. So I think if we can actually have their voice in crafting an answer, we can hopefully solve a problem and perhaps make sure that there isn't a second or third time for Chase or whoever it is to cheat people. So I appreciate the hearing today. If it's acceptable, I would like to try to bring something back in the next couple weeks.
All right. Thank you much for your testimony. Mr. Fuller, I know you've signed up to testify. Sounds like Representative Evans would like to have a further conversation. You can either testify now or have a conversation, come back later. What's your preference?
I won't belabor the committee.
Thank you for that. Yeah, it would be nice to allow Rep. Evans to have some conversation, see if they can work something out in a bill that provides some sort of solution to this. That would be useful. It's interesting to me that, I don't know, it seems like it was fraud, you know, what was described to me, and I don't, fraud is a criminal violation, but I don't know my law that well, so I'm probably just conjecturing on my own, for my own amusement. So with that, I'm going to close House Bill 3322 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2858.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this measure establishes a process and timeline for the director of DCBS to follow after complaints received alleging a violation of the insurance code. It permits the director to enter negotiation to settle the complaint on behalf of the complainant, and it permits the director to enter into remediation agreement to remedy any violations. Specifies that the complaint is to be dismissed if the complaint is made more than 1 year after the alleged violation, if the complainant brings action in court, or if there's no substantial evidence found after a year of investigation. Prohibits the respondent from engaging in conduct that deprives the complainant of services or benefits that they're entitled to under their contract or policy. Provides a private right of action when a person suffers an ascertainable harm as a result of a violation of the insurance code. Specifies statute of limitation is 1 year or 90 days after the director dismisses the complaint. Provides a right to a jury trial, injunctive and other equitable relief, damages of $200, whichever is greater, as well as punitive damages. Allows the court to award reasonable attorney fees and costs to the prevailing plaintiff. And it subjects SAFE, the State Accident Insurance Fund, to the provisions of the measure. Finally, it gives the authority to the director and the attorney general to assess civil penalties on an insurer or other person for any pattern or practice of denying or resisting the rights provided by the insurance company. Sorry, that was so long. It's a big bill.
I would expect nothing but thoroughness. Are there any amendments proposed?
I'm sorry, no amendments today.
Okay. Paul Turdall and Art Towers.
Thank you, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. My name is Paul Turdall, and I'm a resident of Northwest Portland in House District 36. I'm here today as the requester for this bill and as a consumer advocate. I think many of you have seen me around the halls here for the last 6 or so years working on various issues related to health care and education insurance for autism and other conditions, and that was really the genesis for this idea. I should add that professionally, my work is as a business consultant in a number of different industries, really helping companies basically design and implement business processes and really comply with the regulations and everything from nuclear to healthcare to communications, even commercial phishing. And so I have, a strong sense both for what it is like as a consumer to try to work through these processes as well as for a business to try to comply with regulation. Specifically, over the last half dozen years, as a volunteer, just in my own free time, I've helped well over 100 families with various issues related to appeals and denials for insurance coverage. That has ranged from simple questions to pointing people to the right direction within the insurance division to, in some cases, referring them to attorneys. I am not an attorney myself, and assisting as a consultant attorneys with several class action lawsuits that unfortunately have been necessary to address some of these things. Ms. Nordland gave you a basic overview of House Bill 2858. The basic idea here is to establish a transparent and efficient process that the insurance commissioner can use to really respond to and manage consumer complaints for restitution or enforcement of the insurance code. The idea that we had here, you've seen a number of these kinds of issues, proposals over the last few years, generally involving the Unlawful Trade Practices Act or some other form of private right of action where you directly go to an attorney. This is intended to be a different take. The idea here really was based on the existing process that the Civil Rights Division uses to address civil rights enforcement. So that was where we started, you know, to look at it. And yeah, in terms of why we need this, there are, as a consumer, sort of looking at feedback from the industry over, you know, on these the various issues over the years, there are a number of sort of comments from the industry that have really resonated with me. And you know, the basic message is, if you are a consumer and you have a problem, you should go to the insurance commissioner. That's where you should go. That's what you should do to get help. And that's, as a consumer, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do. I want to go to the insurance commissioner for help. And the, you know, a number of years ago, I was talking with Commissioner Savage about some of these issues, and he pointed out to me that, you know, he didn't have the authority to do restitution. He didn't actually have the authority to order an insurance company to pay a claim. And I helped them fix that. I went ahead and I wrote Senate Bill 414, which passed in 2013, and that bill granted the insurance commissioner the authority to seek restitution, and on behalf of a consumer for actual damages, force them to pay a claim, even do compensation for things related, you know, for harm related to that. And I think it was a great bill. I'm really happy that we did that. And the key things, though, are that, you know, this is the authority to do it. The problem is that while the commissioner has the authority to do that, it is only done as part of an actual enforcement action, which is something that is extremely rare. There's no real process for how you get there as a consumer. The, you know, consumer advocacy unit, there are great people there. They're eager to help consumers, but there are really no laws for how we do it. The only statutes on the book, there's one requiring the director to record complaints, to think about them when issuing license renewals, and to do an annual report and keep them more or less confidential. There's nothing describing what the commissioner has to do in response to a complaint. As a matter of practice, they do follow up, and we'll talk in a moment a little bit more about, you know, what the process looks like for that. But, you know, there's, you know, their focus really is on, you know, having a conversation, seeing if they can do things, collecting data. It's not on doing that restitution that Senate Bill 414 authorized. And, you know, really, most critically, you know, when they run into issues, and it's actually even on the website, I was looking at it last night, you know, if you can't resolve your issues in that first pass for advocacy, they actually encourage you to get an attorney and consider litigation. You know, it's, you know, and I have seen that many times before. I mean, that's what they're actually doing rather than trying to push this through litigation. This is basically what the process looks like, you know, in terms of the picture. So as a consumer, our access is to the Consumer Advocacy Unit. When we submit a complaint, it goes to Consumer Advocacy. And the Consumer Advocacy Unit works with the consumer, they work with the insurer to see if they can resolve things informally. And in most cases, this works. In some cases, you have a consumer who just doesn't understand their policy. Like I've seen this one myself, why are they charging me a copay? You know, what's this deductible thing? Well, the answer is it's in your contract, and, you know, that's just the way it works. There are cases where there's just a miscommunication with the insurer, and again, they do a very good job of resolving that. But they can't solve everything, and there are some cases where either if they see something that looks troubling in consumer advocacy, like there could be a violation here, and if they, particularly if they can't resolve it, they will then pass that information along to the market surveillance group. And that's the point as a consumer where your visibility ends. You do not get feedback from market surveillance about what they have seen. That's confidential. The market surveillance unit will basically look to see, okay, did this happen to anybody else? Is there a trend here? They may do a data call and basically proactively ask the insurance company, hey, can you give me all of your statistics on how fast you were processing claims? And they may do research to see if anybody else has been impacted. And if they do see a pattern of violations, they then may refer that on to enforcement and say, you know what, I think there might be something that needs to be acted upon here. The enforcement may then do additional research beyond that initial data call. They may do a more comprehensive market conduct exam where they will go in, perhaps take testimony, you know, collect more specific data, and analyze that and determine, is there something here that we really want to enforce? And if so, that and only then is where the question of restitution would come up. And the critical thing here is there is no consumer or involvement and visibility in any of these pieces. And, you know, and this can take years to get through here. There's nothing specific from my complaint to restitution. In my own family's case, I submitted a number of consumer complaints back in September of 2011. That's 5.5 years ago. They are still in process. I have met regularly with the insurance commissioner, who basically gives me the fact that, yes, we are still working on it. They can't tell me what they're finding because that's confidential. It's in this surveillance and enforcement process somewhere. They can just reassure me, yes, we do care and we are still working on it. About a year and a half ago, when we were hitting the four-year anniversary of things, I basically said, look, I'm about to run out of my statute of limitations. If I have to sue in court, I got to do something or I lose my rights. And the response was, we are working on it. I don't think we're going to make it in time before you run your statute of limitations out. So I went ahead and filed, purely as a pro se litigant, a case in Multnomah County Court to preserve my statute of limitations while they continued their work. After an additional year, I basically got to still no enforcement. I basically got to a point where I had to begin hiring an actual attorney to move my case forward, because as a non-attorney pro se litigant, there's just not much I can do. And that's where we are. One of the things that is interesting here is, you know, the many complicated pieces of my own family's case, one of them involved an improper attorney fee clause. There was a clause in my contract saying that even if I won litigation, I couldn't recover my attorney's fees. I didn't fully understand it in the past, but that conflicts with the insurance code. There's a procedure in the insurance code, 742061, basically specifying circumstances in which you can recover attorney's fees. And in my complaints, as I was going through litigation, I added that in as something to look at. 2 weeks ago, I was contacted by the press. I was actually in a lobby at my medical office, and my cell phone lit up with email messages, and a couple of news organizations were asking me for comment because the insurance commissioner had just issued a proposed $250,000 fine against my insurance company over my complaint, and you know, my name and the documents that had been released to the press. That was the first that I knew that they were taking action on my complaint. There may or may not be restitution. I did suffer harm specifically over the attorney fee issue. I have no idea whether any restitution is being considered. I wrote it down on my consumer complaint form. Haven't heard anything. But that's just because the process behind restitution does not exist. It's just not there. And, you know, I appreciate the hard work they're doing. I know they want to help, but the process behind all of this is just missing. There are a number of other consumers that I have worked with that have been harmed probably more than myself, and I think some of them submitted some testimony. There's one I put in some notes in toward the end of my deck if you want to look at it later. Back in 2014, they were trying to get coverage of applied behavior analysis therapy for their child. And we had already established a clear record that denying it on grounds that it was experimental or not medically necessary would fail. And so rather than doing that, the insurer said, okay, we're not going to pay for it because your provider is not appropriately credentialed. It happened, however, that the provider had been grandfathered under Senate Bill 365, and while the insurance terms weren't there, her credentialing was clearly resolved. And the insurance division contacted their insurer and said, we've looked as part of this market advocacy, right? Contacted them and said, actually, you're wrong. This provider is eligible. You really should pay this claim. They told the insurer, pay this claim. The insurer said no. That was their response to the insurance division. No. We will not act until you order us to act. That family had to give up their job because they desperately needed that health care. They had to move from Bend to Portland to get a new job with a new employer with a health insurance plan that was willing to comply with the law and to comply with the insurance commissioner's directive. That shouldn't be necessary. 4 years later, three and a half years later, they still haven't had their claim paid. We now know abundantly, absolutely clearly, we have a DOJ opinion, we have insurance commissioner's bulletin specifically stating that their denial was unlawful. Their claim still hasn't been paid. That's ridiculous. And so that's really what we're trying to solve here. What we're trying to say is, look, you've got the authority to do restitution. You've got all of these tools. We need a process that makes this thing actually work. And so that's what we were looking at. I have some notes here about, the frequency of enforcement actions. Basically, there are a handful every year. I think there were a total of five in all of last year, none in 2015. It's very rare to actually get enforcement. And so what we're looking for is a process or a framework we can use to do it. They already have the authority. We want a way that consumers can go through to resolve this problem. There are probably some cases that the insurance division is just not going to be able to resolve, either because there's a policy question, because of some political issues, and we have run into political barriers with getting the law enforced. In general, the insurance division is most eager to enforce things that are completely blatantly obvious, where even the insurer has to know they stepped over the line. They don't really like to do things where there could be an argument. For those cases where someone tries to work through the process and it just doesn't work, we need to make it possible. I am currently involved in litigation against my insurer. I never wanted that to happen. I couldn't make the process work. It is ungodly expensive. My friends, the McHenrys, a number of years ago had to pursue a lawsuit against Pacific Source over autism coverage. Their plaintiff legal bill was $210,000. They got a damage award of about $30,000. And they got their attorney's fees back. That was good. But they had to put hundreds of thousands of dollars on the line in resources to get their claim paid. We need better tools that when consumers simply have no alternative but to litigate, that they have a legitimate and reasonable way to do it. And so that's what we're trying to do here. Establish a real process that can work to make it actually possible to get enforcement through the insurance commissioner. And as a backup, if that just really doesn't work, then have a private right of action.
Thank you for that pretty thorough overview of the bill. So I've got a lot of people left to testify, and I doubt that I'm going to get through them all.
Okay,
but Art, if you could give us your testimony in a nice, concise way.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I really don't have too much to add to that other than we support the bill. I will say that we're enthusiastic about the idea of the government transparency piece to this. I think that that's a really good piece of the proposal. I'll also say that the insurance industry is an industry that probably is the most common source of complaints to our members. And the other piece to this is that these are David versus Goliath type cases. I mean, they really, really are. You know, a family that's dealing with medical issues like this shouldn't have to deal with legal issues like this as well. And so that's the other piece that I'd urge the committee to consider as you think about this legislation. We do urge an aye vote. Thank you.
Just one quick question. Is there a pathway to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act with a private right of action? On these sorts of cases?
A
short answer, yes or no, would be good.
Maybe. Okay. Short answer, maybe. All right. And the bill as written doesn't address that. Okay. And, you know, that's something that we can look at. I think there are some creative questions as to what actually an insurance company is and, you know, those entities that are out there that we, you know, healthcare service contractors are sort of quasi-insurance companies. And I think there's an open question for whether they are actually as exempt as they think they are.
Thank you for that qualified yes or no. So I'd like to move on to some more testimony. One more question, Representative Hurd.
I probably have two quick ones to Mr. Paul.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Or to Paul, if that is. Paul, do you know if this legislation potentially gives attorneys the opportunity, say, like a two-car crash, an attorney could come in representing the offended, I guess you'd say, would they be able to sue potentially the victim's insurance as well?
I have seen that kind of feedback in the written testimony, and I don't really understand that issue. And if there's something that we need to fix to address it, I'm certainly happy to talk about it.
My quick follow-up. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you anticipate that this could result in moderate to large premium increases across the board of all insurances?
So, again, I've seen that feedback, and, you know, I have a lot of experience in other regulated industries, you know, on the inside. And my experience is that regulation works best when there is consistent, clear, and fair enforcement. And a lot of what I have seen in the autism cases has been wildly inconsistent enforcement and compliance. We had a situation for a couple of years where Kaiser Permanente and Pacific Source were both faithfully complying with, you know, or at least reasonably faithfully complying with some of the laws, and other insurers were not. And you had people literally, let's say they had one insurance plan with one company, they were going and buying a second insurance plan from somebody else who was willing to comply with the law. That's ridiculous. I mean, that in itself, that raises issues. It incentivizes bad behavior. So when we talk about rates and things, I think, you know, we need a situation where insurers understand that they need to look at the laws, they need to follow the laws, they need to proactively come into compliance. And I'm less concerned about that. And bear in mind also, this directs people to work through the commissioner. And I think the commissioner can probably head off most of these issues a lot faster than they would be dealt with now if there's this kind of process. And so I don't really think there would be that kind of increase. I think it would really stabilize things.
Thank you.
Was that a maybe? Maybe raise rates?
You know, everything in the world could have an impact on rates. I think it's more a matter of stabilization.
Thank you. Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it your sense that the problem that this bill is trying to solve is more, I know your experience is primarily on the life and health side, mm-hmm. but is the problem this bill is trying to solve more on the life and health side, or is property and casualty also an issue? I appreciated some of the data you've shared in your presentation about complaints, but...
So my own personal experience really is on the health side. You know, those are the issues that people come to me and ask for help about, and so I don't really have the experience on the other one, but I think it's a good question. And I don't know, Art, if you have more experience there.
Chair Holvey, Representative Fahey, we see it in a variety of different settings. Auto insurance is obviously one that's a big deal to us, but we see these problems in a variety of settings. We had a very interesting testimony in 2015 from business owners who were experiencing some of these same problems as they purchased their insurance. And so I thought that that was noteworthy also, that it's not just individual consumers, but also business consumers of insurance. And I was startled to, I should have known this, but I was startled to see how much insurance businesses are required to have or want to purchase. And so they see these problems as well.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today. I really appreciate you bringing the issue forward. Up next, I'd like Brian Williams, Steve Patterson, and David Rossmiller. Good afternoon, gentlemen. If you'd identify yourself for the record before you give your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Holley, members of the committee. My name's Steve Patterson. I proudly work for Oregon Mutual Insurance Company, one of the state's domestic PNC carriers located in McMinnville, Oregon.
Go ahead and give your testimony then.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm going to start with a qualifier, and I apologize for this. I came to testify about the bill. What I just heard, I'm not sure was about the bill. One of the things that I would want to clarify is what our regulator does. The state regulator is trying to protect two things, both consumers and solvency of carriers who make promises to those consumers. And so as the regulator goes through, they are not the lawyer or representative of any one individual, but of the marketplace. And so when they get into these enforcement actions, what they're looking at is, and they have access to all our files, is to go through and find out if there's been violations, not of whether you didn't get your payment under your policy, but did we violate an Unfair Claims Practice Act or one of the statutes by which we are to deliver the promises we make in our policy. And so I'm a little confused as to what we're trying to fix. Here, what I heard was we're talking about enforcing the contract. Well, the commissioner doesn't do that now. When they order restitution, the ability is to say a carrier has gone outside the lines of how they deliver this promise in a way that has hurt a number of people, and they will ask us to either reopen their claim, to look at those claim and pay any additional that is due, restitution in that way. But it's not to take an individual consumer and say, boy, I really think you got hosed here. It's time for us to turn around and make sure that they pay. And this bill that we're here to talk about really imposes a different system. So I would tell you up front, I think the bill is double trouble. It's double regulation for our industry. We're already regulated by the Department of Insurance and a lot of laws that have been passed here with good intention and good effect. It's double lawsuits for insurance companies. We'll have to defend our policyholder who might get sued by a third party, and then we're going to have to defend ourselves against the third party that goes to the Department of Insurance and ask them to sue us, or a third party. And it's a double whammy for consumers because they're going to pay both higher premiums, to your question, Mr. Hurd, and they're going to have there's going to be a tax effect on this, either through the amount of people that the department's going to have to hire or the court system to handle, because there's a lot of these little things. And we're talking about, did we blow a 15-day correspondence? That's a technical violation of the code. Are we going to be defending those? It says ascertainable damage. I was stressed out. I didn't know if they covered my claim. Is that stress worth less than $200? Because you can get $200 and then sue for your attorney fees. So at any rate, some of this double lawsuit stuff that we've seen in other states has just never worked, which is why I've been back in Oregon proudly, went to college here across the street at Willamette at the law school. I've been, first time I testified here at the legislature, I think it was in this room, although it wasn't the same furniture. You might not know the difference. It was 32 years ago. And now coming back, I can think of at least 20 of those years in which we've been talking about these kind of double lawsuit bills. And we've made some concessions as an industry, the fact that there's restitution that's now officially allowed by the Department of Insurance and the Commissioner to go directly to consumers was a 2013 compromise that was made between the industry and the proponents of that bill. And just last session, we had a compromise in which more transparency, which I heard in the prior testimony, was going to come to this effort as a result of people being able to go to the department and get records on what complaints are being filed against what companies. And so we've had those. But in the other states where they've actually gone to this step and put in an additional lawsuit measure, California comes to mind as one. We do work in California. From 1987, well before that, to the late eight to 1989, their Royal Globe era, they saw increases that were incredible. In fact, when it was overturned, it was overturned by the state court system, who said they found fraud had increased, that the number of lawsuits has increased, that the court system was being burdened with unnecessary litigation, and also that companies were settling claims for amounts that were inflated as a result of just having litigation being held up to them and said, you're going to pay for the litigation or you're going to pay us a little extra money. And so I want fairness. I want our company to pay what is owed under the contract, but I don't want our people that do that work every day to have a gun held to their head that says, you're going to have all this expense and you're going to end up paying more. And we can pay almost any claim you want. Consumers don't want to pay for that. They can't afford it. One of the reasons they told us in the last session with the bill that was mentioned, why don't people buy insurance? The number one issue is it's too expensive. And so they make compromise. They don't insure enough or they don't buy insurance at all. Where they've had these bills, and I would include Washington, which is seen in the coverages that it refers to, an inflation of over 20% in the cost of their claims. Now, the commissioner and advocates have come forward and said, well, when you look, the premiums in Washington haven't gone up. And that may be true if you look at a pure premium paid by policyholders, but Washington consumers don't have to pay for uninsured motorist coverage. They don't have to pay for PIP. So people are giving up coverages they would have had or insuring for less in order to pay the same amount of money. I think this is an unnecessary inflator of those costs.
Thank you. Get a couple more people to testify. I appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Representative Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I'm David Rossmiller. I'm a partner at the Betts Patterson Mines law firm in Portland. I am here on behalf of the FAIR Coalition. I am an insurance coverage litigator. And so I deal with suits on insurance policies every day. I deal with analyzing insurance policies and looking at the insurance industry and what's going on across all lines. So when I looked at this bill, a few things were pretty striking about it. The first thing when I read it, I thought was, this is a bunch of solutions. Not just one solution, but a bunch of solutions in search of problems. Okay, I'm not seeing, it sounded from what the testimony that I heard earlier today that actually the system worked. And so many things in this bill, the proposal here is to address things that actually aren't problems or are already being dealt with in some fashion effectively. Another thing I thought when I read this is these solutions that are in search of problems are really expensive. I don't know how the department could implement any of these things, much less all of them. This is a massive undertaking for the department to do. We also saw, I read the materials that were presented on the board and read them with interest earlier today. I see this as being analogized to a civil rights issue. And BOLI has a certain way of doing things. But very difficult to transpose that into the context of
insurance contracts to make that a civil rights issue. I think those two things don't go together, and we're asking for trouble if we try to mix them because it's just not going to work. Some of the things that are troubling about the bill, the specifics of the bill, that look to me like creating chaos, is that the bill actually sets up the department as not only a prosecutor but as the court. So it's an alternative administrative court in addition to the Oregon court system. And not only that, it has different rules than the Oregon court system. This bill allows discovery of insurance files and individuals' files that are not allowed by the Oregon courts. In Oregon courts, in federal courts that follow state evidentiary law, you can't do discovery on claims files. You can't do discovery on, of course, attorney-client communications between the counsel and the insurer. A lot of things. You can't look into underwriting files. All these things, it says that the department can get. So, and then be adjudicated, and that's allowed there. And then it can be that stuff that isn't allowed in the Oregon court system. It can be transposed over to the court system through these second lawsuits, or it even says in here that if under certain conditions, if the complainant wants, then the department is going to actually bring the lawsuit in federal court. I would like to see how that would work. So the department, I'm going to be on one side and the department's going to be on the other side. Who are their lawyers? Are they going to hire outside lawyers? Because I don't think they have the staff or capability to do that. So what happens? Do they have to spend a bunch of money hiring counsel to actually bring these suits? At taxpayer expense. Pretty remarkable. Pretty remarkable what I'm seeing here. There are already remedies, and I'm going to
thank you.
Pass.
Got a Thanks. Few more minutes left, and I want to get at least this one more gentleman on the record.
Thank you. My name is Brian Williams. I'm a partner at a Portland law firm, Pitt Hiller Monfils Williams. We're a six-lawyer firm. I get hired by insurance companies to defend policyholders who have been involved in an accident, whether it be your neighbor kid comes over and somebody has an accident at your house. You get sued, I would defend you. That's the nature of my work, by and large. I would also say that I have voluntarily helped clients at no charge who have had policy disputes with their insurers, getting health coverage billed, medical bills paid, and that kind of thing. So I think I see both sides of this. I just finished a three-year term on the Oregon Association Defense Counsel Board. That's 700 lawyers in Oregon that primarily do defense work, and the OADC is opposed to this. I want to emphasize, though, although I do work for Oregon Mutual and I do work for some other insurance companies, I took the day off to come here. I am not a lobbyist. After the last set of elections, I was frustrated I didn't do more, so here I am. Let me explain to you very briefly what my concerns are and why I think this is bad for Oregonians. The first part of it is the current system actually works. I can tell you that at Oregon Mutual, for example, because I picked up the phone to ask, when the Department of Insurance sends the company a letter of investigation, the person that signs off on the response is the CEO. When the Department of Insurance investigates one of these complaints, at least with the companies I'm used to doing business with, they get taken extraordinarily seriously. With GEICO, I think it's a senior vice president of claims that signs off on these letters. And part of the reason for that is because complaints get publicized and it's a competitive basis for insurance companies. They don't want these complaints. They're concerned about these complaints, and they certainly want them resolved as early as possible. So my first point is, I believe, and having represented policyholders who have these kinds of disputes, while it might be imperfect in some situations, by and large, the current system actually works. Second point I would make, I represent lawyers. That's part of my practice. I represent lawyers who have been sued for malpractice. And when I looked at this, I couldn't tell whether it applied to lawyers or not. And I think there's a strong argument that it might. When you look in particular at Section 9, Clause 8, it says that the Attorney General can find that an insurer or other person is engaged in a practice of violating the insurance code. So if I'm representing an insurance policy or insurance company who's trying to deny a claim for potentially a very valid reason, and somebody thinks I've now violated, am I going to get sued personally? And I think there is a legitimate argument that yes. So when you're looking at this law that's being proposed, I would be very concerned about the scope of it and it being a lot broader than it might seem on the surface. Somebody said you have to have actual damages. I read this, and that's just not true. The statute in Section 7 says you have to have actual damages or $200, whichever is greater. So if you don't have any actual damages, and this is a true situation that you see in Washington all the time under the IFCA rule that they passed, an insurance company is required to respond within 10 days, say, and the letter gets sent out on day 12 instead of day 10, you now have a private right of action to sue your insurance company for sending you a letter 2 days late, and you're entitled to $200 plus your attorney's fees. That's not good for Oregon business. It's just not, and there are a lot of lawyers that make money on that. So who are the winners in this? People like me who get to defend those lawsuits, the plaintiff's lawyers that bring those kinds of lawsuits. The losers are the consumers in Oregon that are affected by the changes in premium because it does require a lot of resources to respond to these complaints. And what we're talking about here is one of the things that drives me nuts on a personal level. When I have a client who has a problem, I try to focus on the substance of that problem. Some people want to focus on procedure and deal with procedural problems. It gets in the way when you're trying to resolve somebody's substantive problem, whose fault was an accident, how much were you injured. It gets in the way when you start talking about procedural things like, hey, you forgot to send me a letter on day 10, so now you owe me extra money for that. That's the kind of thing that's going to be injected into these conversations. It's not helpful. It's not helpful in getting people's disputes resolved. Another concern, very briefly.
You got about 30 seconds.
This says not only past violations, but you can file a complaint for something that you think is about to happen. Not just actual problems, but a concern that somebody might do something in the future, you can file a complaint over that. That's not ripe. There's not standing for that kind of thing. It files that violates all kinds of basic notions of common sense. So I oppose it. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate your testimony and pointing out the specifics that you did. So I really appreciate it. Obviously, we're not going to get through the rest of the people that have signed up on this bill. I will carry over House Bill 2858 to Monday to get the rest of the testimony. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2858. Anything else, Jan? And adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.